I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Where is the gold?
This is the Gold News of the Podcast, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you would like more mining, precious metals, economic freedom, please do hit that subscribe button and or go to goldnews.com/podcast for our archives. We have an old friend of the show, and it's been way too long since we last had her on, Fabi Lara. She is, from memory, originally from Brazil and Portugal. She's another international person. And she has her own, she's done lots of things, but she's focused a lot on junior mining as a private investor and educating others how to engage with it. So you can follow her on Twitter at The Next Big Rush. And is your YouTube channel the same name?
Yep, The Next Big Rush.
Okay, Fabi, welcome. And maybe you want to give us a little bit of update on the work you're doing these days. So you're still putting out educational content on YouTube and but you've kind of evolved a little bit. Now you're actually working more directly with junior mining companies.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Fergus. It's been way too long, a number of years, if my memory serves me right. And yes, I'm actually working on a secret project. So you're kind of like poking at the stuff, at the stuff I'm not yet supposed to talk about. But
okay.
So as a private investor and being a millennial and having been, you know, investing in mining and junior mining companies for I don't know how many years, I've come to understand the sort of information and communication needs that we as retail investors have. And now I'm helping companies kind of get their branding right, their communication right, and actually sort of create a bridge between, you know, what they want to show, what they should focus on, you know, regarding communications and where people are. You know, I believe that the internet is a place with many different rooms, and you got to be in the right room talking to the right people with the right message in order for people to be aware of your company. Because there are a lot of great junior mining companies right now at really good prices, but nobody knows about them, right? And I think that more work could be done regarding just getting the word out there. So that's what I'm focusing on in the background in a secret project that people will hear about it soon enough. Okay. I am building a sort of platform where companies will be able to reach people and be more discoverable more easily with a lot less manual one-to-one work. That's
cool. Good, because you're right. This is I was just at the New Orleans Investment Conference last month, and I was just thinking, man, tough time. A lot of these great companies doing hard work and struggling to get attention to convey their story. There's just not the audience there, it seems. And I just find that confusing because, of course, to you and me, these are great opportunities, right? We have the interest, and we're trying to understand why do not more people share our optimism. And so the topic I wanted to explore particularly today is a little bit, I mean, we obviously gold news that we focus on precious metals, but actually in one of our previous episodes, I discussed the fact that there is a renaissance in nuclear power now, but the uranium market, as far as I understand, is so controlled by, let's say, nationalized companies that it's a little bit unpredictable. Let's just set the scene. What is the context in terms of the rising demand, let's say, for uranium, and then where the supply comes from to meet that demand?
Okay, no problem. So what has been happening, I want to say, in the last 2 years is that countries all around the world have come to the undeniable, inevitable conclusion that as a species, we need more power, and we cannot be too picky in what kind of power that is. It just needs to be what's available, right? And that has opened up a plethora of, you know, different options. At the same time, nuclear energy has been looked at or re-looked at with a more practical point of view by these countries. And they're weighing risk versus reward, and they're coming to the conclusion that we absolutely need nuclear if we want to, one, just maintain baseload power and make sure that We have power when the sun is up and when it's dark, when it's windy, when it's not. We absolutely need, you know, that basal power that holds things together no matter the weather. And the other thing is that nuclear is green. Nuclear is green energy generation. And if you want to achieve any sort of green goals that any country has agreed to or set out to do, then you absolutely need basal power, because you do need basal power for your industry to work in any country, but it needs to be green. And within baseload power generation, the greenest source is for sure nuclear, best risk to reward. And then you see that sort of renaissance being led by developing countries, right? Countries that cannot afford to just do solar because it's sexy, or just do wind, and invest in things that make sense now. And don't get me wrong, these guys are expanding absolutely every source of energy there is. They're expanding oil if they can, or they're trying hard to expand oil, but they're not able to right now. They're trying to expand coal, and they're expanding nuclear energy generation as well. Take China, for instance. They are more than doubling their fleet in the next 10 to 15 years. And that when China says they're going to do something, for better or worse, the way that the government works there, they get it done. And many other countries are following suit and coming to the conclusion, do you know what? Chernobyl, you know, happened right up when I was being born. So I was born in 86. That's when Chernobyl happened. That was a very specific case of a type of power plant that doesn't even exist anymore. Like the type of technology that doesn't exist anymore, basically no safety regards compared to what we have nowadays. That will not happen again. Then you look at Fukushima, a very specific case as well of maintenance that wasn't being done in the right way. And just a freak accident of many things happening wrong all at the same time. Whether that's likely to happen again or not, I doubt it, because with every, you know, accident we have, there's actually very little loss of life. That's one thing, but there's actually a lot that we learn from it and we improve. And so my belief is just that people are coming to their senses and they are finally realizing that we need more nuclear, and uranium is right at the beginning of that power generation. We need uranium because we take it. And this is something that new uranium investors need to realize. You don't grab uranium and put it in a power plant. There is a process. And because there is a process of production and changing the material from yellow cake to a gas that turns into a pellet, et cetera, it's so long that you can tell almost always when the market is going to tighten for uranium, because you see it tighten first at the end of the cycle, right? And so right now you're seeing it tighten a lot at the sort of closer to power generation end of the spectrum. And then you see the gas up to the gas, which is step two here. Also, the market tightening quite a bit. And then you know that you need more uranium to produce more gas, to produce more solid pellets, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really exciting because there's been an imbalance for so long. It's been so unprofitable to be a uranium miner for so long that miners have either stopped producing or have lowered their production numbers, and they're waiting for better prices. And I've seen the spot price go from $18 to 50, and that's just a small portion of the market. So things have been moving in the right direction, but it's very slow. Everything happens very slowly in this market.
Okay, and so I assume actually there are many opportunities in that processing. Let's say they're almost at the production line, but and is Uzbekistan one of the major producers of this? What
is a major producer? Yes, but the number one producer is actually Kazakhstan.
Okay.
So they produce, I believe, 40% of world consumption today. They absolutely dominate. I believe on a comparison basis, they're probably more powerful than OPEC. If you compare, you know, how much of the market that they can control, they are by far the cheapest producer. And they're partly a government-owned company. And so they are able to bypass or write in the laws or delete the laws that says what they can and can't do, that kind of thing. I'm not saying they do that, but I'm saying that if they wanted to, they could.
Yeah.
And so they are not bound by the same environmental restrictions that Canadians have, that Australians have, et cetera. So they're able to produce cheap pounds. However, their resources will not last forever, and they know the power that they have. So it is not in their interest to keep the prices down for too long. They are already saying themselves that in order for the market to keep on being fed uranium, prices must go up because of inflation and because it's just worth more. You know, the really, really cheap uranium, I believe, has already been mined.
Are there publicly traded companies also at work in Kazakhstan then?
So this particular company is called Kazatomprom, and you can invest in it. Yes, so you can invest in it, and that's the sort of the public portion of the company that is investable. So yes.
So it's a almost like a mixed company there, public and private partnership, right? And so, but you say, for better and for worse, that particular company has incredible dominance over the market, and it is, we're sensitive to anything it chooses, you know, however, whether it chooses to withhold or release, everyone else is somewhat at their beck and call.
In theory, it would be. However, we have to remember two things. One is that in mining, you have physical restrictions which don't really allow you to ramp up as much as you would like.
Sure.
You can look at many different miners of any sort of commodity, and you'll see that sometimes they want to ramp up, they don't have personnel, they don't have the right equipment, they don't have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other factor, and this has been true for Kazatomprom, especially the last 12 months, is that they are bound by the higher costs that have come. Sometimes they actually claim that they have been struggling to get the needed chemicals in order to extract the material or to process the material. And if you can't get the chemicals, guess what? You can't ramp up. But then a third thing on top of that that Kazatomprom has been struggling with is to actually ship the material out, because they are very close to Russia, and they are actually handling uranium.
I mean, are they landlocked as well? I assume so.
Yeah. So there are different paths that that they can take, but the problem with most paths that they try to take in order to, you know, feed, say, U.S. utilities or whatever utilities that they're shipping out to, is that they have to go through different countries that each have different rules regarding the handling of a material such as uranium, and also sanctions. And so there's the fact that Kazakhstan has been historically very linked to Russia. Some of the material actually goes through Russia. And if it goes through Russia, are they under sanctions? Are they not? That will depend on where they are. And it's actually extremely complicated. When they can get it, it's more expensive. And it's also very difficult to insure for obvious reasons. So there are challenges to them ramping production. And they have been saying that they want to increase production for, I think, the better part of 3 years now. And every single year, they actually come out with numbers that don't meet, you know, the sort of expansions that were planned. So I find it unlikely that all of a sudden that they're going to be able or even want to ridiculously ramp up production. They already own 40% of the market. I think they understand that they don't want to crash the price single-handedly.
The Gold Newsletter is proudly sponsored by Inventa Capital Corporation, a venture capital advisory firm dedicated to the acquisition and development of assets in the natural resource sector. Today, Inventa is one of the premier mining groups with a first-rate portfolio of companies and a world-class team.
This is the Inventa Capital Mining Update. I've got Craig Parry, Executive Chairman of Vizsla Copper. That is VizslaCopper.com. On the Toronto Venture Exchange, it is VCU, and over-the-counter VCUFF for Americans. Now, we're recording this on Thanksgiving Day, so November 24th, and they actually have a press release out today. So you've got three projects, but one is the chief focus, and that's been, do you want to clarify, finalized? What's the outcome of the latest, let's say, consolidation?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, happy Thanksgiving. I hope everyone's having a good one, and there's a lot to give thanks about this year. We spun Vizsla Copper out of Vizsla Silver about 12 months ago, and we've been really focused on building up a bigger land position and acquiring quality projects, primarily in British Columbia, primarily for the great metal that is copper. So we achieved that. We announced this morning that we had court approval for the merger of the two companies. Now sees us really move all of our focus predominantly to the Woodjam project, which is an extraordinary suite of already proven porphyry district. There's some fantastic proven porphyries there. The Woodjam guys drilled out a number of those porphyries, proved up a large resource. I think we've got nearly 1 million ounces of gold in resource. A couple of billion pounds of copper, 1.7 billion pounds of copper, I should say. Fairly low-grade stuff. But what drew us into the area, what really excites us about it, is the fact that some of these areas where there isn't a resource yet have had really spectacular drill hits that fell on deaf ears. They were put out typically 10 years ago in the depths of the last mining depression, really. The market didn't really appreciate, hasn't even seen a lot of those drill holes. So we'll be refreshing all of that, drilling in and around those. We've got some basic work, geophysical surveys. We want to do a VTEM survey over the entire area and then get in and follow up where the guys drilled years ago. And that the market hasn't appreciated. And, there's some examples, for example, at our gold-rich Deerhorn porphyry system where the guys drilled 110 metres at 2.6 grams per tonne gold and 0.44% copper. So nearly, 3 grams gold or 3% copper equivalent over 110 metres. That's never been put into a resource. So over the next 6 months, you'll see a lot of news refreshing that. Just going back and looking, I'm, of course, the chairman of Skeena Resources. We acquired the Eskay Creek project off Barrick a couple of years ago. And I think everyone had assumed that all of that gold had been mined out. Well, the resource base there at Eskay Creek is now over 5 million ounces of gold and gold equivalent. And all of that was largely discovered at the desktop level. By going back over old data. So we'll be doing that here. I think you'll see resource upgrades over the next 12 months as well. But the primary thing for us is alerting the market to what we actually have here in this transaction and getting in and following up where those drill holes haven't been followed up and drilling in and around those areas. So, the news flow is going to be absolutely spectacular once we hit the ground running early in the new year.
Do you want to comment on the location? This place is near somewhere called Horsefly, which is way up there in British Columbia. I don't know what the weather's like at this time of the year, but when you say the information flow can keep coming, how do you handle a project in that isolated place?
It's not actually that isolated. It's 30 kilometres from the major regional centre of Williams Lake. It's fairly flat terrain, probably a balmy 0 degrees there today, but very close to the existing Mount Polly mine, good road access. We can operate year round, which is important. If anyone's ever heard me talk about how you rank and prioritize exploration projects. Size of the prize, cost of the test, chance of success. Well, that cost of the test is so important. And so having good road access is important. And we've got year-round road access. There are forestry trails all through the area, including new forestry trails. And we were up there a couple of months ago. And in a new road cut that was put in by the loggers up there, we found some seriously interesting copper staining and alteration at surface in a new road cut in an area that hasn't been explored at all in the past. So it's starting to uncover the potential there, but you can operate year round. So you'll see new news flow continuously from us. The great thing about being in BC as well, you know, it's a known porphyry district. And of course, we've got that existing resource base. So it's proven. But there are a lot of porphyry centres here that haven't been tested, haven't been drilled. You know, raising capital to do that is relatively non-dilutive and straightforward compared to most other parts of the world, because we have access to flow through funding here, flow through capital. And importantly, you know, the government here has brought in further incentives for battery and electrification metals, including copper. So we can raise money at a serious premium to our share price through flow through funds and flow through sources of capital. So, you know, we're in great shape to hit the ground running, get in and start drilling as soon as we've confirmed all the targets that we're working on at the moment. Very, very exciting project. You know, it's heating up this area. We're starting to see new deals being done all the time in the district. I can tell you that as of today, all of the majors, including you know, and some of the sort of more prominent copper producers of the world, have started to take a real interest in the entire central part of British Columbia, this area around us here. So, you know, I think we've got a big area. It's a massive area to explore. Of course, we want to do that, as much of that as ourselves as we can. But I think that you know, the opportunity to farm out some of our projects to others and have them explore the ground for us is important as well. But suffice to say, year-round news flow. Right. And I think in Venture Capital today, we've got about 21 rigs turning around the world. And one thing that we do well here is put our investors' dollars into drill holes. So that'll be the focus for us over the next little while.
Right. And as we mentioned before we got recording, it has been a challenging 6 months for junior explorers. And how much of a turning point is this Woodjam acquisition?
Well, it's crucial for us. You know, we've been working away on this for 2 years. So to finally get to this point, I'm absolutely thrilled. It's, you know, it's a very, very accretive transaction for all of us. You know, Bill Morton there at Woodjam, a very well regarded and successful explorer. But unfortunately, you know, Bill and his team were working at a time when the market had very little interest in exploration, and particularly copper exploration. So sort of from that period of 2011 to pretty much a couple of years ago. And so they did some fantastic work. They found some tremendous deposits and came up with some brilliant targets, but it all fell on deaf ears, unfortunately. So for us, very, very straightforward. We're good at getting word out about projects. I think we've got a great following in the market now with some of the successes we've had. So, you know, it's a pretty straightforward job for us. The potential of the area is proven. There are existing resources there. They're fabulous drill results. And it's just a matter of getting onto the ground, drilling more holes and alerting the market to what we've really got here.
Sure, folks, you can learn more about it. There's a fresh press release at vizsla.com, on the TSXV at VCU, and over-the-counter, VCUFF. We've been speaking with Craig Parry, Executive Chairman of Vizsla Copper. Thanks for your time.
Good on you. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, because of course it's not just like they've got a whole bunch of uranium in the barn to just, you know, not like a bunch of hay bales to put on the truck. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
So, And but I guess what you're saying is that their supply is much more, let's say, inelastic than one might believe. And that means that as demand ramps up, it's not as though they're just going to be able to increase to meet that. And that will provide opportunities elsewhere, which I guess are more interesting from an investor perspective. And does that mean there's actually more exploration going on as well?
100%, yes. And there's a lot of exploration going on everywhere around the world. And there are a lot of former, you know, exploration companies that are now developers that have a resource in jurisdictions that are now, you know, not under sanctions and don't have this current complication. Obviously, because of higher costs in 2022, they're also coming out with feasibility studies and PAs and whatever else you get that are not favorable because the costs are so much higher than they used to be even 3 years ago. But there are many companies that have gone through the process and have uranium in the ground, pounds in the ground, as we used to say, and are actually now close to start producing, but the companies that are close to production right now are not going to be able to flood the market because they're smaller operations, and they have I guess smaller contracts to begin with, right? So no mine all of a sudden starts producing at 100%. So these guys that are going to be starting producing in 2023, I can think of two off the top of my head, one in the US and one in Niger. They will start off with very small operations compared to their actual resources. So at the right price, there's some production coming online, but the demand, the surge in demand is absolutely not even comparable to, you know, the coming supply. And in fact, I believe that supply has been actually coming down. You had, you know, MacArthur River by Cameco offline. And they have been trying to get it back into production, but it's very, very difficult to all of a sudden snap your fingers and get all the people you need to go work up in Saskatchewan for whatever price. You don't have enough people with the right knowledge at the right price in order to get it done. And then there's a very, very high cost of maintenance to those plants. And so the Cameco has been saying for, you know, quite a number of months that they're going to start it up soon, but the soon hasn't panned out yet.
That's what I was just thinking right then, that even if these firms are either exploring or becoming developers, is the actual, you know, price there to justify producing? That's my concern. Like you said, if you've got all this supply from Kazakhstan that has much lower cost of production, can these new firms really make a go of it at the current level?
Yeah, and that's something that that's a sort of a take that I've been having recently. Is I'm starting to poke around and say, guys, a lot of companies that are close to producing, they have done the work and the calculation, the financials, based on costs that don't exist anymore, right? And everything is more expensive. The cost of capital is much higher now. The market isn't really hot for anything, you know, in mining as of today. Yeah. And you have the fact that, you know, interest rates are really high. And so when you sit down and you're looking at a development company and you're looking at the NPV and you see that the discount rate is something like 5%, you have to ask yourself, why is it 5%? It's a mining project. Everything that can go wrong in a mining project will go wrong. We know that. And
I'm surprised it's not 20%. Yeah.
I know. And at 5% discount rate in today's environment, where we're definitely above zero, it begs the question, like, are we going to, you know, do this profitably? And the answer, I think, is no, not yet. This is one of the reasons why the price of uranium absolutely has to go up. We're starting to see actually utilities come back to the table and start contracting again. So they haven't been contracting for a number of years in any sort of size, because they still had material in massive inventories from before Fukushima. So we're talking, you know, 10 plus years ago. But those inventories are dwindling. There are a lot of extensions to some plants that are happening all around the world. A lot of new construction. Japan is coming back online because they absolutely need it in order to make sure that, you know, their people have affordable power generation. And utilities are starting to come to the table. And now it's the miners' time to say, okay, we will mine and ship material to you. As long as we can get the material out, depending on whatever sort of political situation is happening at the time, right? That's also a caveat. But we will do it at a price. And that's important because most of uranium buying and selling happens in long-term contracts. And so contracts are being signed right now at a rate that they have not been signed for several years. You know, we just surpassed, I think, 110 million pounds contracted this year so far, and the year hasn't finished. We haven't been able to breach 100 million in a very long time because everybody was sitting on all this inventory. Now they're starting to come back to the table, and there's a lot of uranium yet to be contracted. And we believe that this, well, I believe we're not, I'm not saying, you know, like me and my cat and my dog. I believe that this is the beginning of, you know, uranium being repriced. And then that allowing miners to actually make the numbers make sense, because it will absolutely have to come down to that.
Yeah, it is a peculiar market because there are, let's say, so few suppliers or producers. It's a bit lumpy. As you said, there are these private contracts. It's not cleanly traded. But
yeah,
as many people will know who have been in this game for a while, there was a big, let's say, period of excitement about 15 years ago. And so my assumption is, or interpretation is, that you suspect this is going to achieve that and maybe even more now.
Yes. However, when I say that, the prices, I think, will easily reach, you know, 140, which is the past non-inflation adjusted high in 2007.
Yeah.
I think they'll easily breach that. But I think what people think is not, let's make a bet on uranium. Let's make a bet on the companies, because you hear the stories about a company that went from 10 cents to 1 cent to $10, right? And that's the story that people remember, and they want to bet on that, right? So when they come to me and they ask, you know, what are you investing in? What they're actually asking is, what do you think has the highest chance of seeing that happen? And the reality is, we need to look at current market caps, right? What is the market cap for such and such company? And does that make sense with what they have in the ground, with their NPVs? Does the NPV even make sense at these prices? And if they don't, at what prices do they make sense? And can you do a calculation that will put you there, right? Because most people don't realize that when you invest in a company that goes from 1 cent to 10 bucks, the 1 cent was probably a market cap of like $1 million, $2 million, right? Something very, very, very small. So if you're coming in now and you're picking a company that's already at $500 million, guess what? If the company is a good quality company, then you're likely going to, you know, make some money if you're able to, you know, time yourself well. However, if you're buying something that's close to fairly valued today and you expect it to go absolutely bananas, then, you know, I don't know what's going to do that. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend that. You know, it's one of the reasons why I like to look at really, really tiny companies that have a shot at, you know, going multiples.
Well, not only are these companies small, but they'll be illiquid, right? Not highly traded. Like you said, as soon as 100%. They get, $500 million is a good point. There's so much action that there's not going to be this low hanging fruit to really enjoy big gains.
And it doesn't look like anything when they're at a couple of cents, right? People are going to come out of their woodworks and say their projects aren't good. The management, you know, isn't the right management. They have no cash. There are many reasons to not buy a company when they're at 1 or 2 cents or whatever the price is, or the market cap being so small. And there needs to be something that makes sense with your style of investing to say, no, this is cheap compared to whatever you're looking at. And then that's when you make your bet, and you have to hold it for, you know, through better or worse. And I'm not good at the exit part of the equation. That's why I like to get my entries really, really cheap. The stock needs to be really cheap for me to want to get in the first place.
Well, one advantage, though, to these small cap stocks is that the institutions are reluctant to really get involved with these very smaller companies. Even the smaller RIAs or investment advisors in the United States that are dealing with individual clients don't want to get involved. So that's where it's really opportunity for people who are a bit more risk loving, maybe.
Yeah. I agree. And I don't know if it's Ian Castle or Morgan Housel that says that one of the items on your, you know, boxes to be ticked when you're buying small caps is actually the lack of liquidity and sometimes even institutional participation, because you want to get in before the institutions, if possible. But if not, you want at the very least for there not to be much liquidity. Liquidity means there are enough people that know about the story. And you don't want to be sort of at the edge of, if you can imagine concentric circles, right? You don't want to be towards the edge of people who are hearing about the story for the first time, when there are, you know, people who've heard about the story and have held the stock for several years. Everybody knows about it. Everybody's trading it. You don't want to be that last person. And so it looks illiquid. The chart doesn't look good most of the time, but there needs to be something there fundamentally that makes you think this is actually worth today more than what the market is giving it credit to. And there are so many opportunities out there in mining in general, not just uranium. I like gold as well.
Yeah, there are many. And Fabi, yeah, you've got this video YouTube channel, The Next Big Rush, and people should follow you on Twitter. Where else can they go to? I mean, like you said, you've got maybe a project coming out soon. So just hold tight.
Yeah, hold tight. Definitely follow me on Twitter. In fact, people who are investing in mining or small caps and are not on Twitter, you guys are not in a room full of extremely smart people that are talking about things that you should know about. And so do go and get a Twitter account. You do not have to publish anything or write anything. Just go follow some interesting people that will challenge what you're trying to do portfolio-wise. And you're going to learn a ton. And when this platform is ready, I'm going to come out everywhere and talk about it. But definitely Twitter is going to be the number one place where I announce it for sure.
Yeah, and not only is it informative, but it can be, let's say, if I can say, playful, right? It's really enjoyable. Mm-hmm. People put all these spicy memes and the like. So it makes it more of an enjoyable journey. So yeah, Fabi Lada, she is on Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, The Next Big Rush. We'll have all the links at goldnewsletter.com/podcast. Fabi, that went way too quickly. I look forward to next time, okay?
Thanks.